sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list. Live from Seasons Restaurant on Main Street in Bangor. On The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Hey, welcome in. It's the third hour of Downtown on a Tuesday afternoon from our Quality Jewelers Studios at Seasons in Bangor. Rich Kimball, Ryan Waning with you on The Pulse, WZON. This hour, we've got the good, the bad, and the ugly. Dennis Price, an entertainment report, and a little Cubs talk, I'm sure, as we get ready for the World Series tonight. And we kick things off in this final hour of the program by getting on board the G&M Family Market phone line and connecting with Del Quentin Wilbur. He is a journalist who's worked for the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Post, and these days for the Los Angeles Times, the author of a number of books, including a brand new one entitled A Good Month for Murder, the inside story of a homicide squad. Del, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
I've been immersed in the works of Del Wilbur over the last 48 hours, and I'm loving it. I want to talk also about Rawhide Down, which was a fantastic book. But let's start with your latest one, where you embedded yourself, if you will, with the detectives in Prince George's County, Maryland. And there are few police departments, I would think, that would be tougher to be around because of what they deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah, you know, I really wanted to. I've always been intrigued by homicide detectives, detectives in general, and how they do their jobs. And so I wanted to peel back the veil on that, how you really go about solving a murder. And so I fished around, and I finally found the perfect place to set this book, which was Prince George's County, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C. It's 500 square miles. It stretches everything from bucolic farmland to gritty inner-city neighborhoods. And, you know, I said, you know, I asked the police department to let me embed with them. I can't believe they agreed. There I was for 6 months trailing these kind of, you know, very intense, aggressive, kind of nutty characters for, you know, like I said, 6 months. And I focused the book on just 1 month, a crazy month, 12 murders in 28 days.
Yeah,
2013.
12 murders, three police-involved shootings, and on the hunt, too, for a pretty notorious killer as well. As you spent time with these detectives, what did you learn about them as people? What kind of characteristics does it take to be able to handle that job on a daily basis?
Well, you know, to be a really good homicide detective, you have to be persistent, you have to be creative, and then you have to get lucky. And I really enjoyed watching them do their jobs. And this is not a book for the faint of heart. Like, if you like crime stories, probably for you. And I don't get into the politics of what's going on very much. I just focus on, like, how do you read a crime scene? Who these guys are? I mean, these are the crazy. To do this job, you have to be missing a couple screws because you're dealing with death constantly, and you're dealing with the worst 1% of the worst 10% in this jurisdiction, you know, these killers. And so I had, like, a diet pill-popping cheeseburger eater, a chain-smoking vegan, a dude who bragged about the herbal erection enhancers he took, and the female quarterback of a semi-pro football team. And those were the investigators.
And what I found fascinating, too, was their ability, and I certainly have to develop this over time, to be able to have a pretty good idea of who's guilty and who's innocent. And part of that came with their observation of people in the box, the interrogation room. And I loved the story of what they call the felony nap.
Oh, yeah. You know, like, they would watch, you know, so the box is the interrogation room. It's this windowless, like, 15 by 15 square gray room with this little television camera in the corner. That's where they interrogate people. And, you know, these guys were really good. They could size you up instantly whether you were telling the truth or not. I still remember one moment, like, oh, this guy has the best story. I don't want you to believe him. Like, no, he's lying. He's lying. I'm like, come on. He's telling the truth. It turned out he totally was lying. I totally missed it, you know. They're so good at judging people, like, almost instantaneously. Sometimes that gets them in trouble down the road. But the felony nap, you would go look through this little peephole, and if someone was, like, pacing around the box, like, nervous, you know, even peeing their pants or whatever, they were innocent. But if they were, like, taking a nap, like, sleeping, which they did, like, they'd fall asleep on the table, they'd fall asleep in the chair, they'd fall asleep before, they were guilty. They were not, they had, some switch went off in their head, and they were just relaxed. I have no idea why.
What was the reaction of the people that you wrote about in the book once they had a chance to see it?
Well, you know, I didn't pull any punches, and I told them what I saw was going to go in the book. And the only things I kept out of the book were a couple little details. details that would have hurt a prosecution or maybe hurt a witness. You know, I didn't want to hurt anybody because, you know, snitches get stitches in rough places like this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that on my conscience. And the detectives, for the most part, felt it was really fair. And one said, I saw one guy post on Facebook that, you know, hey, you know, if you want to know what my life is like, read this book. This is what it's like. And everything in it is true. And I've often approached storytelling as things are true. There's truth in fact. And like the Bible is true. Is everything in it factual? No. Right. But in my view, I wanted to do both. Everything has to be factual because it's narrative nonfiction. You know, I'm telling a true story, but I'm also and a factual story, but I'm also telling a true story. I want this to speak to something broader. So when the people who read it, no matter how bad they looked or how good they looked at it and said, you know, you got it exactly right. And so far, that's the sense I've gotten.
After your experience with these guys, Dell, do you feel better or worse about our criminal justice system in America?
I don't know if I felt... I felt better that I think that public servants can get a bad rap sometimes. And the detectives I focused on were all very dedicated, and they all really cared. Like, they all really cared about getting it right. And I was around them for 6 months, so I was there. If you read stuff in the book, you can tell they kind of forgot I was there.
Mm.
And so I don't think they're acting for me. I think they really believed that. And that made me feel good. By the end of the book, I was pretty traumatized, though. I mean, I've seen so much death that I pretty much had PTSD by the end, which also gave me a greater appreciation for what they do. And, you know, like watching the video, I had to sit with this one detective who watched basically a video of a murder over and over and over again to try to find that missing clue he couldn't find. He was obsessed with it. And by the end, I was watching this video. You know, like you watch a horror movie and you see this woman opening the shower curtain and you're like, don't open the shower curtain. There's a killer in the bathtub, right? Or going behind a door. I found myself screaming for the victim. Like, don't go in the apartment complex. Don't go in. And like, that's when it became all too real for me.
We're talking with Dell Quentin Wilbur, the author of a new book entitled A Good Month for Murder, The Inside Story of a Homicide Squad. I also had a chance to read Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. And as a history teacher in my day job, I was absolutely captivated by this. And a story that we think we know until you read the book and realize there's a whole lot that we didn't know, including how close to death President Reagan actually was those years ago.
Yeah, you know, I think that March 30th, 1981 was one of the most dramatic days in U.S. presidential history. I mean, you know, the life of the president literally hung in the balance of a split second decision and a mere inch. You know, a mere inch, the bullet was lodged just an inch from Reagan's heart. Things were so touch and go that I interviewed a surgical intern who literally held the beating heart of the president in his hand during surgery. You know, the stuff going around on the periphery and what the agents had to do. And the lead agent that day, Jerry Parr, you know, he passed away last year. But if Jerry Parr had been a split second slow or hadn't made a critical decision in the moments after Reagan was shot to divert to the hospital instead of going to the White House, as we all know, Reagan was shot, you know, by John Hinckley outside the Washington Hilton Hotel on March 30th, 81. But no one at the time actually knew Reagan was shot until much later when he was in the hospital. But if Jerry Parr hadn't made this split-second decision to get to the hospital, Ronald Reagan would have died. And history would be a lot different if Reagan had passed away 70 days into his first term.
And even as they headed to the hospital, Jerry Parr and others thought that worst-case scenario, maybe it was a broken rib from throwing him into the car.
Yeah, you know, it was so crazy. No one knew how bad he was hurt. He was in a lot of pain in that limousine after he'd been hit. And they thought, in part, thought maybe he'd broken his rib, maybe Reagan. And he got to the hospital. They pull into the hospital. And the reason Parr decides to divert to the hospital and not the White House is because Reagan put a napkin to his lips in the limousine, and this bright, frothy blood was there. And he was like, oh, my God, that's not good. It's probably from the lungs, so I probably did puncture a rib. I got to get in the hospital. And Reagan insisted on walking inside under his own power. And I interviewed a paramedic who was there, watched Reagan coming in, walked in his own power, and then suddenly the president turns ashen, his eyes roll in the back of his head, and he collapses like a dead weight into the arms of his agents, and they rush him to a trauma bay and put him on a gurney, and they can't detect his blood pressure. It is so low, he's in shock, And at the end of the day, they eventually figure out he got shot. The bullet had deflected off the limousine, and so it had been flattened in the shape of a dime and didn't leave much of a mark. But he had so much massive internal bleeding that he would lose more than half his blood volume that day. You know, he was 70 years old at the time, and so, you know, Reagan was very lucky to have lived. And if it hadn't been for Jerry Parr to get him to the hospital in that one moment, you know, we'd have George Bush would have been the president of the United States.
And I was fascinated by the fact that some of the people in the hospital didn't realize right away that it was the president of the United States until they asked for his address, and he said 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and that many of the medical people referred to him not as Mr. President but as Mr. Reagan, so they wouldn't be nervous realizing the gravity of what they were doing.
Yeah, Reagan lived for two reasons. One, Jerry Parr gets him to the hospital, but TraumaCare had made a lot of strides in the 70s, and they had set up all these procedures where everyone had a job to do, no matter who the patient was. You do this, you do that, you take this off the shelf, you put this in the patient. I interviewed a technician who literally threaded a three-foot-long IV line from Reagan's right arm to his heart. And only after she had done that, she looked up and goes, oh, where are all these guys with earpieces and Uzis? And looked down and said, oh, my God, it's the President of the United States. You know, they were working so hard and so ferociously. But others were really affected by it. I interviewed a nurse who could not detect Reagan's heartbeat. It was so low. And she began to sob. And she thought back to the one time she saw her father cry. And that was when she came home on November 23rd, 1963, and he was watching the footage of the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, so it was very present for these people.
And for Jerry Parr and the other members of the Secret Service detail, it was an opportunity, too, to reflect and realize that some things had to be done differently. The fact that John Hinckley was able to get within 20 feet of the president is remarkable. And as you write in the book, it's because those appearances there were so routine for Reagan, they in many ways took it for granted.
You know, complacency is a killer, right? It's what causes airplanes to crash when pilots aren't paying attention. It's what causes drivers to wreck on the highway. You're complacent. You're used to this route. You're not paying attention. And they had been to that hotel more than 100 times since it had been built in the late 60s. I don't know, maybe since 72. They've been there 100 times with the president. And they just were used to it. And that's where this rope line was always there. The rope line that held the pilot back was always there. And Jerry told me that the other agents told me, if this had been in Baltimore or Philadelphia or anywhere at Bangor, Maine, you know, they would have done it differently because they would have been seeing something maybe for the first time. So, you know, let's not put the rope line there where the guy could get within 15 feet of the president. Let's push this all the way back to the entrance. And then Hinckley wouldn't, you know, he had a little gun. You know, he wouldn't have, that's a hard shot. But he was very effective, you know. And this day, people think, oh, Reagan got winged, and he almost died. You know, he came within, you know, maybe 2 or 3 minutes of dying, the president of the United States. Not only that, Jim Brady almost died. He got shot in the head, the press secretary. Tom Delahanty, a police officer, got shot in the back and never was the same. And Tim McCarthy, a Secret Service agent, took a bullet in the chest to protect the president while not wearing a bulletproof vest. And, you know, it's amazing that when I looked at it this day, I thought it was a day that almost changed history. And I came, after reporting the book, I came to decide that, no, Hinckley changed history as much as if Reagan had died. Because Reagan and the world was different after this event.
And as I tell my students, it almost continued a real bizarre historical trend that from 1840 through 1960, every president elected in a year ending in zero died in office, and then it almost happened again with Reagan.
Yeah, isn't that the Tecumseh curse?
Yes,
is that what it's
that's
called?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, there's like this curse, and it ended with Reagan, you know, and, you know, thank God, right? I just, people don't, you know, it's just, you know, it's, the idea that happens is insane.
Hey, Del, while we have you here, too, we would be remiss to not bring up a great family connection to the Boston Red Sox, and that's your grandfather also, Del Wilbur, who began his career in 1946 as the Red Sox lost to the St. Louis Cardinals in the World Series, and then after a brief tour of duty with Philadelphia, spent three seasons with the Red Sox in the early 1950s.
He did. You know, he played at Fenway Park for 3 years. My dad has these amazing stories. My grandfather was a backup catcher. We had the same name. And my dad has this amazing story of, like, being in Fenway Park for those day-night doubleheaders and just kind of wandering around by himself in Fenway and, you know, being on a on a bench and having Ted Williams sit down next to him. And Ted Williams asked my dad, "Hey, do you have a silver dollar? I'm going to teach you something about baseball." And so he takes a silver dollar from my dad, and he uses that silver dollar to cover all the ball marks on his bat from batting practice. I mean, that's how good Ted Williams was, right? And he covers the ball mark, and then he pocketed my dad's silver dollar.
That sounds about right.
You know, and so that's I'm a diehard Red Sox fan. I was really disappointed, you know, when they got swept. And I get up to Boston every year for a couple games, and you know, it brought me more joy. Like the last three World Championships brought me so much joy. You know, it's hard to explain. I mean, you probably understand. You guys are all Red Sox fans.
But. Oh, we get it completely. Yeah, and that's why I think for us, having enjoyed that, we understand what the Cubs fans and even the Indians fans, to an extent, are going through, and I think we'll share a little bit in whoever wins that victory.
You know, I will, but I have all these people coming up to me lately going, "I hope the Cubs fans don't become as obnoxious as Red Sox fans." And it really frustrates me. I'm like, dude, you know how often I heard the chants of 1918 when I went to baseball games for, like, the vast majority of my life, what 1986 did to my psyche? And no, I'm going to celebrate that we won three World Championships. And you know what? You're a Mets fan. I mean, what are the Mets? I mean, come on. You're Mr. Mets. Give me a break.
Right, just mascot alone.
I don't mean to digress. I mean, we're talking serious topics. But I don't know. Maybe your listeners feel the same way, you know? Send me a tweet if you feel the same way. Yeah, these Mets fans.
You are among the like-minded here. Yeah, and it's funny you mention that, too, because we don't like Yankees and Yankee fans,
yeah,
certainly, but Mets fans, at least the Yankee fans, have something to be arrogant about.
Yes, I know. You're going to love this. I coach my son's 8-year-old or 9-year-old baseball team, and we're the Red Sox. I made sure we're the Red Sox here in Bethesda, Maryland. And our last ball game was Sunday, and we all gathered, usually cheer, Red Sox at the end of the game as a team. And this time we're all there, and I said, "All right, on three. We're going to say, Yankees suck." We cheered Yankees suck really loud. It was awesome. Everyone's like, "What's wrong with you?" I'm like, "You don't understand."
That's Coach of the Year material right there, Dale.
Yeah, I know. They loved it. The kids just thought it was great. Parents were like, "Can't believe you're teaching that." I go, "They're going to hear a lot worse."
That's right. Just getting them ready for the world.
Yankees suck, damn it.
That's it. Exactly.
Yankees.
Hey, Dale, it's great talking with you. Really enjoyed having you with us on the show. Wonderful books, A Good Month for Murder, The Inside Story of a Homicide Squad, and Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. Dale Quentin Wilbur, the author. Dale, thanks so much for making time for us. Let's do this again. Do it again down the road.
Well, definitely. It'd be great. And your listeners can find me on Twitter or on Facebook, and I hope to hear from them.
Thanks very much, Dale. It's 21 minutes after 5 here on Downtown. Still to come, the good, the bad.